Just you and I.
Just you and I.
Sharing our love together.
So what's wrong with the lyrics of that song? Is there a word or a phrase that you often hear or see misused? Did it bother you when I said very unique a few minutes ago? Or did you say, I could care less? What's the problem with could care less or very unique? We'll discuss the do's and don'ts of language, including how you should spell do's and don'ts this hour, with the author of 101 Troublesome Words You'll Master in No Time. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, July 5th. Do you have an example or a question about troublesome words? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You can also show off and tell us if you know the answer to the questions that I just posed a little while ago. So, let me welcome our guest, Mignon Fogarty, a.k.a. The Grammar Girl. She is the author of several books, including Grammar Girl's Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing, The Grammar Devotional, and the newly released Grammar Girl's 101 Troublesome Words You'll Master in No Time. She joins us from Reno, Nevada, so you're getting up a little early for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hi, Joy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. So there are only 101 words that give us trouble?
No, but these are some of the 101 most troublesome. As I was working on my other books, I kept coming across these words or phrases that I would put aside. I would say, oh, this is a little too complicated to cover right now, or, you know, this isn't really a black and white issue. And so I realized I was getting quite a long list of those kind of words. So, you know, it was time to pull them together into a book. And it's the toughest one I've ever written, but I think it was worth it in the end.
Yeah, why was it the toughest?
Well, because each of these words, so here's an example. So, you know, jealousy versus envy, they're used interchangeably in real life, but traditionalists and language experts will say there's a distinction between the two, that when you're envious, you actually want something that someone else has. But when you're jealous, it's more of an emotional rivalry, a feeling of insecurity, and that you might lose something. So there actually is a distinction between what the two words mean, if you look at the definitions or if you, you know, are really into that sort of thing. But then when you're out in the real world, they are just used interchangeably. So, you know, I sort of went through the reasoning and in the background, but, you know, ultimately the conclusion is, you know, you can choose to make a distinction between them in your own writing, but, you know, you probably shouldn't get too worked up if you see them used interchangeably in your favorite TV show.
Right, and that's what I liked about the book, too, is that in some cases, you know, you say, well, what should you do? And in some cases, it is don't sweat it. In other cases, you say avoid using, you know, this word. Like, for example, very unique, that example that I just used in the introduction.
Right. So unique is a word that means one of a kind. Language experts call it ungradable, which means you can't be more unique than something else. And even very unique sort of implies that there are levels of uniqueness, and that's just not what unique means. It really means one of a kind. And yet, you know, if you're looking at real estate ads, you know, you will always see a very unique bathroom, you know,
yeah.
a very unique decor. And it's out there everywhere. And this one, and this is really the key of the book, is the what should you do paragraph at the end of every entry. You know, I took a stand, I made a ruling, and people won't agree with every ruling I made. But you know, I found that for the most part, people appreciate it when someone does the research and tells them what to do. You know, and these are so complicated, people aren't going to go do their own research. So I advise not to use very unique or more unique. That one, I think, is a distinction worth upholding.
Yeah, on Facebook, right off the bat, Rich writes, what's the story on preventive versus preventative?
Oh, yes. If I remember correctly, those words are both okay. And, yeah, so, you know, sometimes when English has two words that mean the same thing and one is longer than the other one, everyone thinks, well, the shorter one must be right. But it's just not true. And that's another thing. English is so troublesome, and that's what, you know, comes out once you start researching it. We have two words that mean the same thing, preventive and preventative, and they're both acceptable. They're both perfectly fine words, and you can use whichever one you prefer. Now, you know, it probably, you know, for the sake of efficiency and preventive, you know, you're free to use that if you want, but people aren't wrong when they're saying preventative.
Yeah, that's funny because I was scolded once for saying preventative, and now I make a point of only saying preventive, and you're saying that your ruling is either one.
Yeah, I mean, most sources consider preventative to be standard English, and that's, you know, I don't make this stuff up. Mm-hmm. I went and I have a big library of reference books, and I compared their entries on all these different words. And, you know, also looked at common usage and how it's being used, you know, by doing big Google News searches and, you know, and looking at quotations from, you know, TV shows and movies and things like that. So yeah. You know, sort of took a comprehensive look at what's out there about each of these words.
Here's one I really like that's in the book, because we had an example here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and Rob Ferret, who's directing right now, might remember this. We have a show called Zorba Pastor on Your Health, and he has a cookbook that he wrote some time ago, but it was the subtitle was Heart Healthy Recipes, and some people got very upset and said it should be Heart Healthful Recipes, and you take on that debate in the book.
Right, yes. There are people, particularly older people, who were taught that, you know, carrots aren't healthy, they're healthful. But it's just not a distinction that holds any weight anymore. It's just not upheld by anyone. So, you know, one of my favorite things about that entry is, you know, to illustrate the meanings, I did take quotations from TV shows and movies and video games, and I found a funny one that illustrates just how old-timey healthful sounds. So it's from the video game The Curse of Monkey Island, and in it they say, it's a very healthful drink, even better for you than placing leeches on your tongue.
A very healthful drink. Yeah. Speaking of old-time examples, this is actually, I think, Bing Crosby correctly using a troublesome phrase. Let's take a listen.
Balmy breezes are blowing, each star in the sky is glowing, but I couldn't care less.
Some people say I could care less.
Right. So, and this is what, you know, 50% of the time when I do radio, someone will call in and say their pet peeve is people saying, I could care less. But so because, and the reason it annoys people is because it doesn't mean what you say. If you're saying you could care less, it means you actually do care at least a little bit. So the right phrase, the phrase you should stick with is couldn't care less. But it is interesting, though, when I go through the arguments, there are some linguists who say that could care less is fine, and when people say it, they're being ironic, and, you know, it talks about the reasons in, you know, the linguistic reasons why we're prone to dropping the NT on couldn't and say could just because of the sound of the word. So, you know, I go through these arguments that you'll hear about why could care less is fine, but in the end, again, on this one, in the what should you do section, I think people should stick with couldn't care less.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with the Grammar Girl about troublesome words, and Barbara in Madison joins us first. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, what's your question?
Well, I'm wondering if I'm just an old fogey, but I'm very disturbed by people using the word less when they mean fewer. I was taught that fewer related to numbers and less to amounts. And I hear people saying, less cars, less this. And I always thought the proper way to say that was fewer when you were talking numbers.
Mm-hmm. What's the story on that, Mignon?
Yes,
you're right, and it is a common error that you'll hear. Recently, sometime within the last year, Mercedes had a commercial where they were talking about their great new car, and it, you know, the car was zooming around the hills and vroom vroom, all these great things, and it had chains attached to the door. And at the very end of the commercial, the chains dramatically pulled the doors off the car, and it said something like, "More power, less doors." And I got a flood of email of people complaining about this commercial because it should be fewer doors, because fewer we use for things that are countable, and doors are countable. And I think the thing that frustrated me most about that commercial is that they could have fixed it so easily. They could have said less door, you know, sort of in the way we'd say she's showing less leg.
Yes.
You know, sort of a concept instead of a countable thing. If they'd have said less door instead of less doors, it would have been fine. So it would have been so easy to fix.
And it sounds so awkward the way they said it. You think they would have noticed? What about 10 items or less for the checkout line?
Oh my gosh, that is even more troublesome than this book can handle. There are, you know, obviously the majority of people think 10 items or less is wrong, but there are, linguists who I really respect their arguments who say that it's fine. And, you know, frankly, I have not been able to wade through all their arguments and make a decision myself. I think because their arguments are so difficult to understand, I'm not convinced, but I can't go as far as to say it's absolutely 100% wrong.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Barbara?
No, I've heard it quite frequently on local television advertising, and it seems it's getting more and more common, and it grates on my nerves.
Is it popular culture, TV, ads, movies, the like, that keeps on misusing these words and perpetuating this problem, Mignon?
I don't know. It's a very common thing for people to think something is a new problem, and then when you actually start to research it, to find that it's been a problem for 30 or 40 years. So, I'm often surprised by that. I'll hear something and I'll think it's new, and I'll, you know, start doing research and usage guides and say, oh, they were complaining about this error 30 years ago. So it may not be as new as you think. It may be that it's just, you're just noticing it more. You know, it's that phenomena of once you notice something, you notice it more again. It's like saying, don't think about a pink elephant.
Mm-hmm. Here's another one that we run into in the news business, in the writing business, when we're saying something is, do we say something is more than $100 or over $100?
Oh, that's an interesting one, because, this is another reason that there are troublesome words, because we have different major style guides. So the book publishing industry tends to use the Chicago Manual of Style, and newspapers and corporate writers, they tend to use the Associated Press style book. And the Associated Press style book insists that you should never use more than in that way. You should always say over. Or no, I've got it backwards.
Right, the other way around. Mm-hmm.
You should never say over $100. They say that over implies physical distance, that you should always say more than $100. But nobody else says that. The Associated Press is the only one. And one of my other favorite style books, Garner's Modern American Usage, they call it a hoary American newspaper tradition. So, and a baseless crotchet. So, if you follow AP style, you should certainly use that rule. But if you don't follow AP style, then you don't have to follow it. It's not a rule outside of AP.
Good to know. And I won't freak out when I see it anywhere there either. So we are talking about troublesome words. We are talking with Mignon Fogarty, who is also known as the Grammar Girl, the author of several books. Her latest is 101 Troublesome Words You'll Master in No Time. Do you have an example for her? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Just you and I,
just you and I,
sharing our love together.
So is there anything wrong with just you and I sharing our love together? We'll ask our guest, the Grammar Girl, 1-800-642-1234, if you have any questions, any examples about the proper use of certain words and phrases. You can also send an email, talk@wpr.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. By the way, tomorrow at this time, it's the Week in Review. We'll have guests of opposing political perspectives discussing the top news stories of the week. That's coming up in the Week in Review tomorrow, every Friday between 8 and 9. Our next caller is Joe in Franklin, and Joe has a question that's similar to that Eddie Rabbit song. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. I'm sort of a self-appointed member of the grammar police, and one issue about which I've always been sitting on the fence is it he is taller than I with the implied I am, or is it he is taller than me?
Oh, yeah, that is... That is a contentious language issue. Actually, language experts argue about it. There are two camps, people who think it's fine to say then me, and people who think it's fine to say then I. So, you know, what do you do when language experts can't even agree? And the recommendation I give is I just always complete the sentence. I always say, you know, he is taller than I am, and then it's clear which word you should use. But, yeah, it's funny, even you know, people who study language will disagree.
What do you use, Joe?
When I get lazy, I use me. When I want to sound pretentious, I use I. It's just one of those, like I say, about which I sit on the fence.
Yeah, well, thanks for bringing up the example. A lot of times we're afraid to use me, it seems to me, Mignon, that we will inappropriately use I.
Yeah, pronoun errors are one of the most common things I hear out in the world. An earlier caller was asking about, you know, whether popular culture changes the language. And in some senses it does, because a common error is between you and I. It should be between you and me, because when I don't know if your listeners will care, but when a pronoun follows a preposition, it should be in the object case, and me is the object pronoun. So that's the rule why. But you can just remember it should be between you and me. But there are a lot of songs that use between you and I, and there are a lot of songs in general seem to have those pronoun errors. Maybe it's because the artist finds it easier to make the rhyme, you know, with the lyrics, but you will encounter a lot of those problems. And then, you know, I just imagine teachers cringing when their students are listening to songs, you know, like Jessica Simpson's Between You and I, that, you know, it's getting drilled into their head the wrong way. So, you know, there are instances where pop culture does influence the language and encourage people to make errors.
I'm trying to think, that Eddie Rabbit song that I played, it seems if you complete the sentence, is that correct? You and I, just you and I sharing our love together, that's correct.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because there's an implied sentence, so you'd have to imagine it's something like, it is just you and I, and then when a pronoun follows is, it should be in the nominative case, so I is the right choice. But, yeah, it's sort of tricky because is different from other verbs.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Let's go to Amy in Appleton next. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Joy. You're my hero this morning. Twice I heard you pronounce the word O-F-T-E-N, often.
I always say often. What? You don't like it when the T is in there.
I think it's so affectatious to say often. I was a TTY relay operator about 15 years ago for 3 years, and I actually noticed it happening, that people that I was translating for were pronouncing the word often. Yeah. And I wonder if it's a regional thing or if it's...
I don't know if it's regional or not, and I'm not sure if there is a ban on that T or not, Mignon.
Yeah, the preferred American pronunciation is often without the T. The often... pronunciation is, I believe it's more common in Britain. So if you watch British movies, you'll hear them, very hear them saying often. So I remember there's a famous British actress whose name I can't remember, but she's been in a bunch of American movies, and I noticed that she always says often.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a British thing.
Is it better to write okay, O-K-A-Y, or is it okay to write it okay, just the letters?
Oh, this is one of my favorite topics, and it's in the book. So it's one of those AP Chicago things, again, to start with. So the Chicago Manual of Style wants you to write it out, O-K-A-Y, and the Associated Press wants you to use O-K, the letters O-K. But I just love the story behind O-K, because most people think the abbreviation, the two letters, is slang, but that's really where people think the original word came from. In the 1830s, it was trendy for a few years for journalists to make up misspelled abbreviations. So researchers believe that OK is an abbreviation for all correct, spelled O-L-L-K-O-R-E-K-T or something like that. But the misspelling started with the words OK as a jokey spelling for all correct.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and there were a bunch of these funny misspellings back then that then turned into abbreviations, but none of them survived except OK, because Martin Van Buren used OK in his presidential campaign because he was from Kinderhooks, and they called him Old Kinderhooks. So that abbreviated was OK. So the slogan was something like Old Kinderhooks is OK, and that's how it got established in the language.
That's better than Old Kinderhooks, I think. That's funny. Rusty in Baraboo is with us next. Hello, Rusty.
Hello, Joy. Hello, Ms. Fogarty. The thing that I hear a lot of times on advertised, people say it's time to replace your hot water heater. And I think to myself, why would anybody want to heat hot water?
Redundant, isn't it, Rusty?
I don't know if it's really redundant. It's actually incorrect. You want a cold water heater.
Ah.
Because you want to heat water that's not hot and make it hot.
A hot water heater. I don't think that was in the book, but he's got a point, doesn't he, Mignon?
No. Yeah, no, you definitely have a point. There are, you can make whole lists of redundant phrases that people use. Excuse me. You know, exact same is another one. People will say, oh, that's the exact same thing. I mean, I heard myself saying it yesterday, and that really is redundant. If it's the same, it's exactly the same. It means the same thing. And we have all sorts of phrases like that in English. And, yeah, again, once you start noticing them, you'll hear them everywhere.
Is it all right to spell all right with one L?
No, all right should be spelled as two words, A-L-L-R-I-G-H-T. But there's, you know, it's not a strong force right now. You know, words, they go through these changes over time. And I think that's what is so frustrating about language for a lot of people, because it happens just at a pace where you can see these changes in your lifetime. So, you know, if 60 years ago, healthful was the way to say something, you know, now it's healthy. And for the people who grew up saying healthful, that's very frustrating. Like, the pace of change is just slow enough, but just fast enough to sort of put people in that position. And so what did you just ask?
No, I was wondering the correct spelling of all right, because you do see people with just one L or two separate words.
Oh, right, yes. So, all right was spelled as one word with one L is gaining ground, but it's not a strong movement yet. In the what should you do section, I say you should stick with two words, all right. But people started making the push for spelling it the different way back in when people were sending cables, when people were sending telegrams, and you paid by the letter, so it was more expensive to write all right with two L's in a space. So even back then, people were starting to spell it the shorter way. And I think with Twitter and Facebook and all the current pressure to keep things short, to keep your character count down, I suspect that All Right, the shorter spelling, is going to gain ground. But mm-hmm. it hasn't yet. It's still considered wrong.
Linda in Kenosha is with us now. Hello, Linda.
Hi. I wanted to bring up the use of these ones and those ones. My boyfriend does that all the time, and I give him grief about it because I'm sure that it's incorrect, and I hear other people as well.
These ones and those ones?
Yeah, that's I've heard that complaint before, and you know, we actually covered it on the Grammar Girl website. If you do a search for Grammar Girl and these ones and those ones, you'll find an article about it. It's what I remember is that it's more complicated than I thought, and I don't remember the exact rules, so I can't answer that one off the cuff. But you can find it on my website.
Yes, we do have the website, the Grammar Girl website. I think it's called Quick and Dirty Tricks. What is that? The
Quick and Dirty Tips.
Tips.
Tips. People sometimes ask, why is it quick and dirty? And it's something my mom always used to say, that, you know, when you were doing something sort of fast and easy, it was quick and dirty. So we'd do a quick and dirty job on these dishes, you know, before we go to bed tonight. So,
mm-hmm. So anyway, Quick and Dirty Tips. The Grammar Girl's website is linked to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You can check out some of the other troublesome words on there as well. We are discussing her latest book, 101 Troublesome Words You'll Master in No Time. And if you have a question, or if you have an example of a word that you are confused about or you hear misused, we welcome it at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Mignon Fogarty is known as the Grammar Girl. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock talking with her guest about the 75th anniversary of the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. If you're listening to the rebroadcast of this program in the evening, Kathleen, after 10 o'clock, will be talking about summer songs, great summer songs, past and present. Right now we are talking with the Grammar Girl about 101 troublesome words you'll master in no time. And we have an email from Jean in Appleton who says, can you please explain the difference between who and whom? It seems as though the word who has been virtually banished and replaced by whom in places where who should be used. Excuse me. Gosh, I guess I don't hear whom very often at all. But she's hearing it a lot inappropriately. What about that, Mignon?
Yeah, that's interesting. Usually people complain that people use who when they should be using whom.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, it is a troublesome word. It's one of the few things that's in all my books because it's one of the most common questions people ask. So, and there's a little trick. So, ask yourself if you could hypothetically answer the question with him. Right? So if you're asking who or whom should we invite to the party, you could hypothetically answer, we should invite him to the party. So if you're rephrasing the question as an answer, ask yourself, is it him or he? And if it's him, then the right choice is whom. And you can remember that because both him and whom end with the letter M. And the reason it works is because you use whom when you need an object pronoun, and him is an object pronoun. So it's a test case. You know, you're testing your sentence to see if you need an object, and him is the object you can use as the test.
What if I just decide that whom doesn't need to be used at all?
There are people who argue for the abolishment of whom.
Count me among them.
It sounds pretentious, and we should just get rid of it because no one knows how to use it anyway. That's the common argument. And you know, you'll even hear milder versions of that among language experts. But you know, I just don't think it's going away. I don't see the Chicago Manual of Style or the AP Style book or any of those influential books saying, oh, you don't need to know whom anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't see that happening. So,
all right. I guess I'll continue to try to use it correctly. Ken in Butternut is with us. Hello, Ken.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Mignon. My call has to do with a phrase that was used by a Milwaukee DJ, Jonathan Green, way back in the day. And whenever the station put a promotion through, he would always add at the end, "Don't fail to miss it."
And you thought that sounded strange.
Well, to me, it's a double negative, which means miss it.
So if you don't fail to miss it, yeah.
Yeah, it's a double negative. And, you know, I often, when I'm training people to do business writing, I often tell them to avoid double negatives. You know, if you can say that positively, particularly in business writing, you should. So instead of don't fail to miss it, which is the double negative, and people sort of have to parse through that in their brain, you should just say catch it.
Or,
be there.
Or don't miss it, I suppose.
Right, or don't miss it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, you know, slogans in particular, you know, advertising slogans, they're often, you know, people take a lot of liberties with slogans.
All right, well, here's one that we hear a lot of criticism in the news media in particular when somebody has been kidnapped or is missing, that someone has gone missing. People saying that doesn't make any sense. What does that mean? What's the story on that?
Yeah, people hate this. It was the Grammar Girl pet peeve of the year a few years ago, but it's actually not wrong. And I know people hate hearing that, but it's a Britishism. It's from British English, and it made its way into the United States, sort of through that, in the way our news has become more international. I vaguely remember there was a little girl who went missing in Britain, and it was a big deal, and it was such a big deal it was on the news over here too, and I think that was part of what that big news cycle was, part of something that put gone missing in the minds of American newscasters. But you know, it actually, you know, Peaver suggested, you know, it's illogical, but we do have parallel phrases that are the same way. You know, for one that the Oxford English Dictionary points out is go native. You know, if someone, say your senator goes to Washington and you really believe he's a different kind of guy and an outsider, and then suddenly he is just like everyone else, you might say, oh, he's gone native. And that's very similar in structure to gone missing. So,
I see.
You know.
All right, let's take John. I'm sorry, it's Josh in Menominee. Hi, Josh.
Hi there.
Yes, what's your example?
I've got a question about the phrase bi-weekly or bi-monthly. I mean, say you're getting a magazine subscription that's bi-monthly. Are you getting, you know, 6 issues, or are you getting 24?
Right. Yeah, this is another one. This is, oh my gosh, English is so troublesome. Because even in the dictionary, the definition of bi-weekly includes every 2 weeks and twice a week. It means both things. So there, like people can... Like it's not that people are using biweekly or bimonthly wrong, that it means one thing or the other. It can actually mean both things, because the prefix bi can mean two or twice. So, you know, what I advise people in the what should you do section is, you know, it's sad, but you should just abandon these words. You know, you should be more specific. If you mean twice a week, say twice a week. If you mean every other week, say every other week. It's the only way to be clear, because these words, they have multiple meanings.
Does that help, Josh?
Yeah, it's just so ambiguous. It's frustrating.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you very much.
It's troublesome.
There we go. Jan in Marshfield. Hello, Jan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is about the word concerning, and I hear it used a lot. At least to me, it sounds like they're using it in place of disconcerting and using it to mean upsetting. Like, this is concerning to people, and like if they're upset about something. Is that correct?
Are you saying concerting or concerning?
It sounds to me like concerning. I could be hearing it wrong.
She thinks people are using the word concerning when they should be using disconcerting.
Right, that's what I'm hearing, but I could be wrong.
Oh, well, you know, it seemed, off the top of my head, I think that those might be interchangeable,
yeah.
Because, you know, if something causes concern, it can be concerning. So, you know, if you said that new ruling is concerning to me, I think that's fine. You could also say that new rule is disconcerting to me. I think they're interchangeable.
You know, here's one that I'm going to confess that I know that I have misused, bemused. I always thought that that did have a little bit of amusement in it, but it doesn't.
It doesn't. It has nothing to do with amusement. But, you know, as you say, most people think it does. So it's another common error is for people to use bemused for that sort of, you know, humorously befuddled. But that's not what it means. It actually means confused. So, you know, what I advise people is to avoid using bemused in a situation where the sentence is ambiguous. You know, because you should use it to mean what it means, which is confused, but so many people think it means amused. You shouldn't use it in a sentence where it could mean that, because then you don't want to, you know, you could confuse people. They might not get your meaning if you're using it properly or improperly, actually.
Well, another caller, Lori in Somerset, is with us. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Which is correct when somebody asks, how are you today? Should you say, I am well or I am good?
Yeah, that's another common question. So, and a lot of people were taught the wrong answer. So it's fine to say, I am good. It has to do, you know, earlier I was talking about how is different from other words. Well, am is also different from other verbs. It's called a linking verb. And, you know, a traditional verb like swim, you can only use an adverb after that. So you would say he swims well. It would be wrong to say he swims good, because good is usually an adjective. So, but the verb is and am is different, and it's okay to use adjectives after it. So it's fine to say I'm good or I'm well. If you look at usage books, they'll say if you're saying I'm well, it has more of a sense of health. I'm well, I'm healthy. And good is sort of a more broad word to describe. So, you know, I'm happy. I'm in a good disposition today. So they're both fine. But there are a lot of people out there who think it's wrong to say I'm good. So you may encounter some resistance. But you know, if you look at the sentence technically, from a grammatical standpoint, it's actually not wrong.
I always thought I am well was incorrect, because it's an adverb and you're describing the person, so you should use the adjective.
Yeah, it gets more complicated, because well, I think well can be an adjective or good can be an adverb. It, you know, they actually have multiple meanings too. But if you usually when people argue about it, they're saying I'm well is the only thing you should be able
to
say.
Yeah, that's what I had heard. Oh, you should properly say I am well rather than I am good. And so I hadn't heard it the other way, Lori. Thank you very much. Karen emails in La Crosse, please address the misuse of the word myself, as in Joe and myself went to town, or Mary and myself will take care of it. I hear this all the time, and it drives me crazy.
Yes, another common error. So, and another pronoun. You know, we were talking earlier about how pronouns are so tricky, and people are afraid to use me. So they'll say myself instead of me. They might say send the memo to Bob and myself, but it should be me. And you can sort of test the sentence again by taking everyone else out of the sentence. Usually it's more clear to people when they just have the pronoun. So most people wouldn't say send the memo to myself. They would say send the memo to me. And it's the same when you put Bob in the sentence. The way you should use myself is to refer back to yourself when you've already mentioned yourself in a sentence. It's like, I see myself in the mirror. You've already said I, and then later in the sentence when you want to reflect back to that, you use myself It's called a reflective pronoun.
And I like the example about the mirror too. So
yeah.
We are talking.
That's how I remember it.
we are talking with the grammar girl, Mignon Fogarty. She is the author of several books, including 101 Troublesome Words You'll Master in No Time. I'm Joy Cardine, inviting you to join us with any questions you might have or any examples you might want to run by the Grammar Girl, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Wayne in Green Bay is with us. Hello, Wayne.
Good morning. How are you guys today?
I'm doing well.
All right. I have to take your lady to task.
Uh-oh.
You said repeatedly, the reason is because, and it should be, the reason is that. And I drum that into my grandchildren. I said, you don't have to understand why, just do it.
Well, why is that so important to just do it, Wayne?
Because it's correct.
So it should not be the reason is because, it should be the reason is that.
Is that, because you have a nominative clause coming up after is, and it's got to reflect back to the subject, which is a noun, and because starts a dependent clause.
You want to start an argument with Wayne in Green Bay, Mignon?
No, he's right.
You shall be punished, young lady.
No, she shall not. Well, you know, I will come to your defense, Mignon. When you're just talking and ad-libbing off the cuff, sometimes you don't have time to really think about that rule.
Yeah.
And it's easy to make a mistake here and there. Thank you, Wayne. Larry in Madison. Hello, Larry.
Thank you. I'd like the grammar girl to talk about usage of the word absolutely. Seems to me sometimes it's used perhaps in a redundant way. For example, if somebody asks, did you like the movie? And the answer is yes, absolutely. Isn't yes, yes, and for that matter, isn't no, no, without some kind of qualification.
Mm. Yeah, no, I have noticed that too. Absolutely is becoming a word that people use for emphasis. It's becoming sort of a trendy word. I've noticed it, oh gosh, for maybe 10 years, that it's really picking up steam. But the English language, you know, we're not always going for the most economical way to say things. Actually talking about myself, there's a way to use myself for emphasis that I've never heard anyone complain about. So if you say, I baked the cake, it means the same thing as I baked the cake myself. You know, we add it in that in that circumstance, myself is called an intensive pronoun. It adds emphasis to the sentence, but it doesn't actually change the meaning. And, you know, there are certain phrases that people will pick up on that they'll say are redundant or, you know, unnecessary. But we have a lot of redundant, unnecessary things in the language. You know, we're not always looking for the most economical way to say things. So you're right that yes means yes, and yes absolutely is, you know, maybe overly emphatic, but, you know, it adds color to the language.
Yeah, maybe if you really love the movie, you're going to say, yes, absolutely, rather than just yes. Larry, is there anything wrong with that?
No, I could argue that describing certain things, you could use the word absolutely to mean 100%, top, maximum. And other times, like whether you like the movie, there might be gradations of liking where you would say yes, and so it could be added. It could add meaning, as the guest suggested, if you put the word absolutely into the sentence.
Thanks very much, Larry. Karen emails in La Crosse. Oops, no, that's the wrong one. I was going to share this email where Laura on Facebook asked about the distinction between eager and anxious. When do you use these words?
Yeah, that's another common one. Let's see. So eager, they do have a difference in meaning, and you know, a lot of people don't realize it. So eager means you're looking forward to something, and anxious has more of a sense of anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, they have the same root. So if you're anxious about something, you might not be looking forward to it. You know, it might be something that's going to happen that's negative in the future. So you might say, oh, I'm really anxious about my divorce hearing. You know, but when you're eager, you're really looking forward to something. So you might say, oh, we're so eager to get our new puppy. So They do have a difference in meaning. They're often used interchangeably, but I think it's a distinction worth maintaining.
I had mentioned earlier that I was going to ask you whether or not it's okay to take the hyphen out of email when you're writing.
Oh, I like the hyphen. I'm a fan of the hyphen because email is short for electronic mail message. And if you were writing it out that way, you'd hyphenate it. But it's a losing battle. The Associated Press, I think last year or the year before, changed their style guide to say, don't use the hyphen in email. Chicago hasn't followed suit yet, but I've seen informal comments on their website where people were saying they preferred it without the hyphen. So, you know, as much as I prefer the hyphen myself, it's a losing battle. In 10 years, no one's going to be using it.
Our next caller is Patricia in Madison. Hello, Patricia.
Good morning. The grammar girl just used some words that I always have trouble with, and she said it's the comparative and superlative cases where she said more clear, and I would say clearer or even most clear, clearest. So I guess it's also economical way of stating something, and maybe they're interchangeable.
You're right, actually. A one-syllable word should take ER or EST as the ending. The more and most is for three-syllable words and bigger, and then two-syllable words have this complicated set of rules you have to use. It's hard to speak off the cuff. I know I make mistakes every time I do an interview. It's much easier when you're writing and can go back and edit yourself.
Right. So let's go to Sharon in Berlin. Hello, Sharon.
Good morning. I've been waiting for this chant. I think that, and I hear this on television interviewers every single day, I learned to use the possessive form of a pronoun before an ing form of a verb. Your being on the radio pleases me, not you being here pleases me.
Right, yeah. Yeah, this is another one that's much easier to do in writing than in speech. And they have slight differences in meaning. So the example I use on my website is singing. If you say, I hate your singing, that means I hate the singing that you do. It's the singing that I hate. But if I say, I hate you singing, it's more hatred toward the person while they are singing. You know, gosh, I hate you when you're singing.
They
have a subtle difference in meaning, so they're not necessarily right or wrong, but usually the meaning usually people are usually going for is the one where you use the possessive pronoun. You know, I appreciate your picking me up at the airport. I appreciate your act of picking me up at the airport.
We have gone through so many of the troublesome words just a minute or so to go. Are there some others, or maybe, you know, some that are your pet peeves or really the most troublesome of the troublesome that we haven't talked about?
Well, maybe we can do some quick ones. So kudos, even though it ends with S, it's singular.
It should just be kudo?
No, but there's no such thing as a kudo.
Okay.
It comes from Greek. And even though it has an S, it's not the plural form of kudo.
I get it.
So there's no such thing as a kudo. It's always kudos, for example.
Okay. Anything else?
Let's see. Oh, another interesting one is Celtic versus Celtic. So people who study the language, they want you to say it with that hard K. So it's Celtic if you're, you know, studying the writing of the people of the Isles. But it's Celtic when you're talking about the sports team. And there's even a sports team in Scotland who calls themselves the Celtics, even though they would call themselves Celts. So.
I get it. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Mignon Fogarty is the Grammar Girl, author of 101 Troublesome Words You'll Master in No Time. Her website is on our Facebook page, the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thanks to Rob Ferrett, to Bill Martins, and to Naya Mukherjee for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.